Well, you never saw anything like that before.
We had a lot of fun. And I would say that Hillary is highly overrated.
Yeah, both candidates were out campaigning yesterday after the debate on Sunday night, and both campaigns projected an air of confidence about their chances of winning the election.
We have 28 days. November 8th is the big day. We're going to get out. We're going to win. I'm going to make 3, 4, 5 stops a day. I may be limping across that finish line, but we're going to get across that finish.
Here's Clinton in a rally in Detroit yesterday.
We now know who Donald Trump is, but the real question for us is who are we, right? I would argue we are not who he is.
Regardless of the confidence portrayed, both candidates are still receiving backlash from moments in their private life made public over the last week. Good morning, everyone. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Our first guest today to talk about how both campaigns are faring in the wake of the debate, hacks and leaks, is Steve Shepard, editor for the Politico Caucus and chief polling analyst for Politico. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And let me start on your role as chief polling analyst. What are the latest polls saying 2 days after the debate, 4 days after the video came out? Some of the things that I've seen are a tanking of Donald Trump's numbers like nothing I've seen before. But is it enough time to learn anything from the polls that's significant?
Well, it depends on which event you're talking about. If you're talking about the tape, I think there is sufficient evidence to show that that's led to a downturn in his polls. We saw the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that came out yesterday that showed Hillary Clinton up by 11 points in a four-way matchup, 14 points matched up just head-to-head without the third-party candidates with Donald Trump. That was conducted Saturday and Sunday before the debate, but after that tape had sort of slipped in really into the electorate's bloodstream. Since the debate, we really only have – we had a one-day poll for Politico that we conducted with the internet polling firm Morning Consult that showed Hillary Clinton up by 5. That was slightly up from where she was last week. I think it'll be towards the end of this week before we really get an idea of how the balance of these two events, the tape on Friday and the debate on Sunday, really move the needle.
You point out in your piece today that Ronald Reagan was the last presidential nominee who managed a final month comeback. But that year, 1980, when he surged past then-President Jimmy Carter, he was facing only a four-point deficit in October. How did he come back in 1980? Do you know?
Well, that was a while ago. But and certainly the news cycle moves so much faster now. But you did see a malaise in the country. You saw an incumbent president who became less popular as the election year stretched on. You had the Iranian hostages that year, which really weighed on him. The inability to free the hostages in Iran really weighed on the Carter campaign late. Ronald Reagan was very adept and became somewhat likable. He wasn't as well liked as he is now in 1980, but he was able to be charming and likable in those debates, in the one debate rather that he had with Jimmy Carter in late October, that I think really helped him surge past Carter. I don't know that that's what you saw from Donald Trump on the debate stage on Sunday night.
I think the commentators on TV after the debate on Sunday night were giving Trump credit for a tie or even a win, because he didn't completely fall apart. He looked a little bit better prepared than he did in the first debate. He went on the attack against Clinton, both Clintons, in response to the videotape, didn't just completely fall apart and, you know, wind up incoherent like he was in the first debate. If he was incoherent in the face of the tape, then he would have been written off as a big loser in the debate by the pundits. But I think the early polls that came back, tell me if I'm wrong, to the extent that you can tell anything from these kind of instant polls after the debate and focus groups, actually showed that the public judged Hillary Clinton the winner of that debate. And maybe it was because of that lurking that Trump was doing behind her that was so unattractive to so many people and threatening seeming. you know, regardless of what he actually said when he had the microphone.
Well, I think you're right. The handful of scientific polls, including the Politico Morning Consult poll, which was of all voters, and then we filtered in people who watched the debate, the CNN ORC poll, instant poll on Sunday night, which is of people who said in advance they were going to watch the debate and then were called back that night for their instant reactions. Hillary Clinton led all those polls as far as winning the debate. Now, they're not necessarily – people who watch the debate aren't necessarily completely reflective of – the electorate demographically across the board, but I think that is a pretty good idea that voters watch these debates in a different way than I think that we do in the media and the folks on television who analyze these things afterwards do. I think to some extent people in the media tend to watch these debates like a ringside judge watches a boxing match. They're looking for technical things. Like you mentioned, Donald Trump was able to ding Hillary Clinton on a couple of issues aside from the first 20, 30 minutes, which were pretty ugly. He did land some blows later on to further the analogy. But voters at home watching these aren't looking for the same things I think we are. And I do think that there was something about the way he came off, whether it was body language or whether it was his words, that rubbed some, may have rubbed some voters the wrong way, or may have just confirmed what they already thought about the two candidates, yeah, particularly after the first debate. And those perceptions, initial perceptions, can be hard to dislodge.
Another thing that I think may have been going on is that before the first debate, there was a lot of talk about not grading Donald Trump on a curve, not having such low expectations for his knowledge of the issues and his ability to articulate what he would do as president, that if he was then sort of kind of okay on some of the points, that then he would be graded as having done well. And I think the fact that there was a lot of that conversation before the first debate kind of immunized people against actually perceiving it with that bias. There was none of that talk before this debate, and I think the expectations after the Friday video release were so low that when Trump didn't completely fall apart, then he was graded on a curve by the professional pundits, but maybe the public didn't see it that way. House Speaker...
Well, the public...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The public has already formed, in a lot of ways, their perceptions of these two candidates. And so, you know, these debates don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in the context of everything else in the campaign, including the first debate, most importantly, the first debate. So I don't think, you know, we view them as these one-off singular events, and that's not how voters are using them to make their decisions about whom they want to be the next president of the United States.
Listeners, if you want to talk about the presidential race, anything about it, 212-433-WNYC with Steve Shepard, editor for the Politico Caucus and chief polling analyst for Politico, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. House Speaker Paul Ryan, as you know, delivered Donald Trump a withering blow yesterday, telling fellow Republicans he will no longer defend Donald Trump and will instead use the next 27 days to focus on preserving his party's hold on Congress. That's political strategy, not moral outrage, right?
It seems to be. I think that House Republicans and Senate Republicans as well are seeing the same polls or seeing the same data and the same trends in the polls that we're seeing in the public polls, and they know that Donald Trump is likely on a path to losing the election, likely on a path, if he loses the election by a wide margin, say a margin equal to Barack Obama's margin over John McCain in 2008, which was 7 to 8 points or greater, that would wipe out a lot of House and Senate seats for the party as well. And so their focus is on trying, rather than trying to defend things that are very difficult to defend at times, they'd rather focus on winning the races and creating some distance between down-ballot Republicans and the presidential candidate. What
right.
I would also add is that you already see from Donald Trump some indication of how he's going to set up both the latter stages of his campaign now that we're in the final 4 weeks, but also the post-election argument. Hitting Paul Ryan on Twitter this morning, saying that it's hard to do well when Paul Ryan and others give zero support, sets up a post-election blame game if Donald Trump does go on to lose. That, you know, We never had a chance. It wasn't my fault. We got no support from national Republicans. And I think that that sets up a situation in which the Republican Party's been having sort of an internal argument with itself. I don't know if I want to call it a civil war just yet, for years now. And I think it sets up a really interesting post-election stage, the first 2 to 3 months of how the party deals with this internally. Who emerges as leaders of the party, including the next Republican National Committee chairman who will be selected in January, and how Republicans will deal, depending on whether they have the majority or not in the House, with this new Democratic president in the first 100 days. It's going to be fascinating to watch this play out.
And the current Republican chairman, Ryan Priebus, seems to be having the civil war in his own head. So, for example, just before the debate, when the reaction was so strong to the video over the weekend, there was talk that he might actually pull Republican money from support for the Trump campaign, which the Trump campaign really needs because they don't do all that much independent fundraising. And give it all to the congressional candidates. But then when Trump apparently appeared to Reince Priebus to do okay in the debate, Priebus changed his mind on that. And Trump will be getting all the Republican Party money that he was slated to get. At least that's the reporting I've seen. Can you confirm that?
That is the case. Reince Priebus has a very difficult job. His job is to defend and help the Republican nominee for president. That's what the Republican National Committee exists to do. There are already committees that handle specifically the National Republican Congressional Committee does House races, the National Republican Senatorial Committee does Senate races, the Republican State Leadership Committee does down ballot races. The Republican National Committee is there for the national ticket. And it sets up a really difficult situation. Reince Priebus has to serve a number of different constituencies. In addition to that, there are people on the Republican National Committee who really do like Donald Trump, despite the lack of establishment support he has at this point. He does have some support within the Republican National Committee. You also have a lot of people who believe that if Donald Trump loses this election by 4 points instead of 8 points, that it's going to be much better for the Republican Party down the ballot. And so you have those people who don't want the RNC to pull their support. Then again, you also have the folks for whom Donald Trump is a moral test, and they don't want the Republican National Committee or official Republicans to support him at all. And so Reince Priebus is torn between all of these different factions. He's concerned about his own career, but he's also trying to balance all these interests with his job description, which is help the national ticket in any way he can.
Before we take some calls, on that question of Republicans who see what Donald Trump does and says as a moral test, how few of those people are there actually? Because I think when we're talking about Paul Ryan and Reince Priebus, you've made pretty clear that if the reaction to the video in the public was not as strong over the weekend as it was, they wouldn't be distancing themselves from Trump to the extent that they are, that it's a purely political calculation. Of these members of Congress and congressional candidates who are Republicans who've now said that they're not going to vote for Trump when they were going to vote for Trump before Friday, how much of this is moral outrage? I guess another way to ask the question, because you can't get into all those people's heads, is where are the people who are in safe districts unendorsing Trump? And I don't see many of those people. And if you confirm that, then that's an indication that moral outrage is barely in their calculus. And only politics are, and if they can get away without unendorsing Trump, they're going to do it.
Yeah, there are a few. Mike Lee, Utah senator.
Mike Lee was never for Trump, and he was
right,
against.
Right, Martha Roby in Alabama, a member of Congress. But you're right, there are very few safe seat Republicans. And I think you saw this play out a little bit on this conference call held yesterday, Paul Ryan and House Republicans. There are a lot of Republicans who, back home, their voters, if they're in a, say, a 60% Republican district, a safe Republican district, their voters, the majority of their voters who are going to be, by the way, voting in the 2018 primaries, really like Donald Trump and are really excited by Donald Trump. Now, these voters, as a share of the national electorate, only make up 35 or 40% of the vote. That's why Donald Trump seems to be stuck at that number even after this. They see this back home as a potential threat to them in 2 years in a primary, and they're lobbying for the party to stick with him because They know their voters back home, their primary voters back home, are going to be very angry if the party abandons them.
And that's part
of... I think this is why this argument's going to continue in the Republican Party moving forward.
And that's part of the reality that America has to face up to, which is that a candidate who's been saying and doing all these things, the video didn't start it. The video is the last straw for some people. And I think for a lot of Republican elected officials and candidates, it's only the last straw because they see his support tanking and they don't want to be on the wrong side when he's not elected. But it's, you know, he's the candidate of the Republican rank and file. He won clearly in the primaries, and this is the heart of Republican America, watching him do these things over and over and over and over and again, and sticking with him. Or is that too harsh?
Well, I think the danger is not just what he's done thus far, but we saw this a little bit in 2008, some of those late McCain-Palin rallies, particularly the Palin rallies. Things got ugly, in the closing stages of a losing campaign. And we've just seen in the past 15 minutes or so since we started talking, Donald Trump tweeting that it is so nice that the shackles have been taken off me and now I can fight for America the way I want to. I think that sends a chill down the spine of people like Paul Ryan, who are hoping to do this little stiff arm maneuver to keep Donald Trump without abandoning him 100%, to keep him away from House Republicans and from their reelection campaign and the agenda they want to set. Because now it raises the possibility that as ugly as this tape was and as ugly as some of the rhetoric has been, that the closing 4 weeks, that things potentially could get worse. And I think that really should should worry a lot of folks who are trying to maybe have it both ways.
They say there may be other tapes out there and things like that. Meanwhile, the Clinton campaign released new ads featuring Republican voters shedding and shredding their own party's nominee. Here's part of one of those ads.
I became active in the Republican Party to elect Ronald Reagan. I thought I would be able to support whoever the Republican candidate was. I always have. But with Trump on the ballot, I just can't. He does not hold my values or the values of the party.
So Clinton's going after past Republican voters. And I think she said something in one of the campaign appearances yesterday about, or maybe it was just one of her surrogates, maybe you know, about hoping that she could work pretty well with Paul Ryan, assuming she's elected and Ryan is so turned off from Trump and the Trump wing. And that actually worries some people in the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party that, uh-oh, maybe the politics are aligning here, that she's going to be more of the centrist candidate and less of the Clinton-Sanders coalition candidate, depending on how the election turns out. What do you think about that?
I think it does worry some progressives, but I think some other progressives are actually, and this is the same thing that we're seeing in some of these leaked emails this week, that they may be, in some ways, at least they know kind of what they're getting moving into the first 100 days of at this point, what is a likely Clinton administration. You know, when Barack Obama was inaugurated in January of 2009, he ran as particularly on foreign affairs, a more progressive candidate than Hillary Clinton. And I think then progressive groups weren't quite sure what to expect from his governing style. I think they have, or they feel like they have, a better idea of what Hillary Clinton's governing style will be, and I think they'll be able to set the battle lines and figure out the fights that they want to have and the fights that maybe they don't want to have in going into this Clinton administration. I think it'll depend a lot on which party controls both houses of Congress and the kind of things you'll be able to get done, but I think that will sort of – they'll be able to set the agenda in a way that – 8 years ago was difficult to do without really knowing how Barack Obama would govern as a president.
Steve Shepard with us, editor for the Politico Caucus and chief polling analyst for Politico, as we talk about what seems to be, before jumping to conclusion, seems to be a kind of last straw weekend in the presidential campaign of Donald Trump, though things can always change. 212-433-2884. WNYC. And Joel in Fresh Meadows, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joel.
Good morning. I have an observation and a supposition. My observation is, one, when you look at the advisors to the Trump campaign, Bannon, Kellyanne, Giuliani, and Roger Ailes, it's kind of like the cast from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And my supposition is, I think that Donald Trump is running this campaign simply for the money. He's never released any of his financials. I don't suspect that he ever will. I suspect that if anybody ever saw his balance statement, they'd find that he is probably either net zero or in liability.
Joel, thank you very much. On one of the things that he said, and whether you care, agree with Cuckoo's Nest observation or not, putting Kellyanne Conway and Chris Bannon in the same basket there, how much would that be accurate? Because there are a lot of reports that Kellyanne Conway and Chris Bannon are sort of the two, one is the campaign manager and one is the campaign chair, I think those are the titles, that they're actually at war with each other in terms of how much Trump should be doing what he's doing, which is running the scorched earth campaign, as opposed to trying to professionalize himself, which, you know, people have talked about for months and months in the Republican Party, and Trump has never been willing to do.
Well, I think a lot of the people that are currently in the inner circle of Donald Trump's campaign, and he's been through a few inner circles so far since entering the race, they all come from, or many of them come from, a lot of these 1990s era battles, including Kellyanne Conway, including Steve Bannon, including David Bossie, who headed the group Citizens United, which of course is responsible for that campaign finance ruling. But you'll recall that was all based on a movie about Hillary Clinton. That was where that case sort of originated, a movie that they had produced, an anti-Hillary Clinton.
Citizens United.
These are folks who've been fighting the Clintons for decades. And I think that more than anything is driving this change in direction of the campaign. Donald Trump, in his history, has said a lot of flattering things about the Clintons, including through Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign.
Right.
So this marks a real shift for him, and I think that it's because these people have been fighting the Clintons for so long.
The caller also said that he thinks Trump is really in this for the money because it'll enhance his business prospects. I tend not to think so, but also there's been analysis that if he's not careful, and he's not being careful, he's actually going to destroy his brand. He's going to be so toxic. Maybe he already is after the way he's run this campaign and the number of people and groups that he's offended, that it's going to be reflected in the market for anything that has the Trump name on it, which is mostly what he's selling. And this is really going to hurt him financially.
Yeah, for your listeners who grew up in the New York area, and I grew up on Long Island in the 80s and 90s, Donald Trump was sort of this, he had this sort of up from bootstraps, even though we know now that that's not really that, and we knew then also that that wasn't really the case, but he had this persona that people aspired to, at least as far as those who desired money and fame. And he has been able to cultivate that personality in a lot of business dealings outside that really center around his personal brand. So not so much his real estate holdings, but you wanted to go to the Donald Trump casino in Atlantic City because you thought if you win money, you could be Donald Trump. You wanted to wear his clothes at Macy's. You wanted to watch him on The Apprentice. Now we're in a situation where 60% of the country has an unfavorable opinion of him. More than a majority have a very unfavorable opinion of him. Voters think he's sexist. A lot of voters think he's racist. That really does a lot of damage to your personal brand, and to the extent to which his personal brand and his business interests are connected, which I think is true for a lot of his television ventures, that those things, that's really problematic.
I even wonder if they can strip his name from some things that he doesn't actually own, but where they licensed the name. I went to visit somebody recently in one of those Upper West Side buildings that has a Trump place address or sign on the outside from that development he built on the far west side. And I was thinking, God, these people who are probably mostly politically liberal living on the west side probably rolled their eyes in the first place at living in a building that they like their home in that's called Trump Place. What are they going to think now? You know, and it made me wonder, is there even a legal mechanism, since he doesn't own the buildings anymore, to get that name taken down?
Yeah, he is a big part of his business in particularly the post-Apprentice days. You know, he's been a New York celebrity for a long time, but when he really became a national celebrity after The Apprentice was leasing his name. And so certainly fewer people, I think, are going to want to be associated with him after this, based on where his current standing is in the polls with the American people. Here in Washington, you know, he just opened up a very expensive new hotel at the old post office right on Pennsylvania Avenue, only a few blocks from the White House, and between the White House and the Capitol. And, you know, you wonder, versus any other sort of generic hotel brand, it having the Trump name, is that going to be helpful or hurtful for their reservations?
Right.
And thus far, you know, it's only been open for a month, so it's too early to judge. But when you look at what has happened to his image over the past year and a half in this campaign, it's difficult to see how that would be helpful.
Interesting example from D.C. Anne in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So I read this article yesterday by Kurt Eichenwald in Newsweek. He had published a piece. The Sputnik had quoted from his piece and attributed his statement about Clinton and Libya to Sidney Blumenthal.
Sputnik?
I'm sorry?
What, you said Sputnik?
Well, the Russian news media.
Okay.
Or I don't know what did they call whatever they
call
it.
Well, I don't know which news organization, but okay, gotcha.
This was all part of the leak of the emails, and they quoted Sidney Blumenthal. But in fact, Kurt Eichenwald read the quote and said the words sounded really familiar. They were his words from his article. So within a few hours, I guess, by the end of that day, the Russians had taken down that piece of misinformation. But Trump, at a rally, quoted this as fact. I found this incredibly, it just gave me chills, and I don't hear much in on the news about it. I mean, it happened yesterday, but I just haven't heard much. Uh-huh. Have either of you heard about this?
Steve, are you familiar with that? And I'm curious in general, before we run out of time, what kind of backlash there's been to many of the Clinton speech excerpts to the big banks, those private speeches, excerpts of which were revealed by WikiLeaks the other day, that the Clinton campaign has not denied. That would, you know, you can only imagine if they had come out when Bernie Sanders was still in the race about her saying the big banks were blamed excessively for the financial crisis, embracing the kind of Social Security reform that the Simpson-Bowles Commission embraced, which would include raising the retirement age for Social Security, and all these other things that that hardly anybody's talking about since this came out, because the Trump story has overwhelmed it.
Well, two things. One, I did read the Kurt Eichenwald story last night, and it's basically the fact pattern that the caller described is appears to be accurate. A Russian news agency wrote up a story based on this. The story was misattributed a quote to Sidney Blumenthal, and then it was repeated by Donald Trump on the campaign trail. Whether that's just by accident via a Google News result that they just happened to land on a Russian news agency, or there is some sort of combing and some sort of symbiotic relationship between interests in Russia and the Trump campaign, it's impossible or it's difficult to prove. The second part of that is I think true to some extent. I will say that I think actually Donald Trump did a good job, and Hillary Clinton did not do a good job really explaining this during the debate on Sunday night. You know, her story about it being a reference, the public and private positions being a reference to the movie Lincoln. If you go and read the speech excerpt, that is true. Donald Trump mocked it, and I think a lot of voters probably that might be something that actually worked well for him and didn't work well for her. I think he could have done maybe a better job of explaining exactly where, what sorts of positions maybe she was muddying with certain crowds in order, whether it was publicly or in privately in some of these speeches, to financial institutions, doing a better job of explaining why and then on what issues she might not be being completely forthcoming. But I will say that, you know, this is one area where it does feed into an existing narrative about Hillary Clinton. And I think Donald Trump was effective in exploiting that, even if the thing that he mocked her for, which is the Abe Lincoln reference, was actually true. She was talking in that speech about the movie Lincoln.
Of course, not every issue that you give yourself license to take a different position on in public than in private is like slavery and the 13th Amendment, which was the context of the Lincoln remark. But we will leave it there, except to say that the three main news agencies in Russia are Itar Tass, RIA Novosti, and Interfax. There's also Gazeta, which is an online Russian politics and business newspaper. But maybe they would do well to call one of their news organs Sputnik, because that's probably about the last major success that Russia had. Okay. Thank you very much, Steve Shepard, editor for the Politico Caucus and chief polling analyst for Politico. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.